Blog Talk Radio.
So, it's our band, who are really good, and off we go.
There's a train of coming.
You don't need no baggage. You just get on board.
All you need is faith to hear the diesels humming.
You don't need no ticket. You just thankful love for
you never heard the sound like a rubber band.
so much rhythm, grace, and heaven there for one man song. And then you had to know the click of his left toe, but through his knee, got a feeling in his head, y'all. Oh, come on, baby. Won't you try yourself to give it? Never heard a sound. Oh, he's a man. And he likes to dance. Moving up and down, moving up and down, and man. Got a single all in his way. Everything about the things out of place. Move, 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 move. A rubber band.
Deep mix of music and thoughts. Please listen quietly in your heart and mind.
What life has done to those like you and me.
Nixon's successful presidential Moynihan's now infamous report on the Black Family, which attributed Black poverty to a Black subculture and the tangle of pathology that characterized it. As described by sociologist Catherine Beckett, the alleged misbehaviors of the poor were transformed from adaptations to poverty that had the unfortunate effect of reproducing it into character failings that accounted for poverty in the first place. The social pathologies of the poor, particularly street crime, illegal drug use, and delinquency, were redefined by conservatives as having their cause in overly generous relief arrangements. Black welfare chiefs and their dangerous offspring emerged for the first time in the political discourse and media imagery. Liberals, by contrast, insisted that social reforms such as the war on poverty and civil rights legislation would get at the root causes of criminal behavior and stress the social conditions that predictably generate crime. Lyndon Johnson, for example, argued during his 1964 presidential campaign against Barry Goldwater that anti-poverty programs were, in effect, anti-crime programs. There is something mighty wrong when a candidate for the highest office bemoans violence in the streets, but votes against the war on poverty, votes against the Civil Rights Act, and votes against major educational bills that come before him as a legislator. Compelling images of the poor as deserving and competing images of the poor as deserving and undeserving became central components of the debate. Ultimately, the racialized nature of this imagery became a crucial resource for conservatives, who succeeded in using law and order rhetoric in their effort to mobilize the resentment of white working class voters, many of whom felt threatened by the sudden progress of African Americans. As explained by Thomas and Mary Edsel in their insightful book, Chain Reaction, a disproportionate share of the costs of integration and racial equality had been borne by lower and lower middle class whites who were suddenly forced to compete on equal terms with blacks for jobs and status who lived in neighborhoods adjoining black ghettos. Their children, not the children of wealthy whites, attended schools most likely to fall under busing orders. The affluent white liberals who were pressing the legal claims of blacks and other minorities were often sheltered in their private lives and largely immune to the cost of implementing minority claims. This reality made it possible for conservatives to characterize the liberal democratic establishment as being out of touch with ordinary working people, thus resolving one of the central problems facing conservatives: how to persuade poor and working class voters to join an alliance with corporate interests and the conservative elite. By 1968, 81% of those responding to the Gallup poll agreed with the statement that law and order has broken down in this country, and the majority blamed Negroes who start riots and communists. During the presidential election that year, both Republican candidate Richard Nixon and the independent segregationist candidate George Wallace made law and order a central theme of their campaign, and together they collected 57% of the vote. Nixon dedicated 17 speeches solely to the topic of law and order, and one of his television ads explicitly called on voters to reject the lawlessness of civil rights activists and embrace order in the United States.
The advertisement began with frightening music accompanied by flashing images of protesters, bloody victims, and violence. A deep voice then said, "It is time for an honest look at the problem of order in the United States. Dissent is a necessary ingredient of change, but in a system of government that provides for peaceful change, there is no cause that justifies resort to violence. Let us recognize that the first right of every American is to be free from domestic violence. So I pledge to you, we shall have order in the United States." At the end of the ad, a caption declared, "This time, vote like your whole world depended on it. Nixon." Viewing his own campaign ad, Nixon reportedly remarked with glee that the ad hits it right on the nose. It's all about those damn Negro Puerto Rican groups out there. Race had become, yet again, a powerful wedge, breaking up what had been a solid liberal coalition based on economic interests of the poor and the working and lower middle classes. In the 1968 election, race eclipsed class as the organizing principle of American politics, and by 1972, attitudes on racial issues rather than socioeconomic status were the primary determinants of voters' political self-identification. The late 1960s and early 1970s marked the dramatic erosion in the belief among working-class whites that the condition of the poor, or those who fail to prosper, was the result of a faulty economic system that needed to be challenged. As the Edsels explain, the pitting of whites and blacks at the low end of the income distribution against each other intensified the view among many whites that the condition of life for the disadvantaged, particularly for disadvantaged blacks, is the responsibility of those afflicted and not the responsibility of the larger society. Just as race had been used at the turn of the century by Southern elites to rupture class solidarity at the bottom of the income ladder, race as a national issue had broken up the Democratic New Deal bottom-up coalition, a coalition dependent on substantial support from all voters, white and black, at or below the median income. The conservative revolution that took root within the Republican Party in the 1960s did not reach its full development until the election of 1980. The decade preceding Ronald Reagan's ascent to the presidency was characterized by political and social crises, as the civil rights movement was promptly followed by intense controversy over the implementation of the equality principle, especially busing and affirmative action, as well as dramatic political clashes over the Vietnam War and Watergate. During this period, conservatives gave lip service to the goal of racial equality, but actively resisted desegregation, busing, and civil rights enforcement. They repeatedly raised the issue of welfare, subtly framing it as a contest between hardworking blue-collar whites and poor blacks who refused to work. The not-so-subtle message to working-class whites was that their tax dollars were going to support special programs for blacks who most certainly did not deserve them. During this period, Nixon called for a war on drugs, an announcement that proved largely rhetorical, as he declared illegal drugs public enemy number one without proposing dramatic shifts in drug policy. A backlash against blacks was clearly enforced, but no consensus had yet been reached regarding what racial and social order would ultimately emerge from these turbulent times. In his campaign for the presidency, Reagan mastered the excision of the language of race from conservative public discourse and thus built on the success of earlier conservatives who developed a strategy of exploiting racial hostility or resentment for political gain without making explicit reference to race. Condemning welfare queens and criminal predators, he rode into office with the strong support of disaffected whites, poor and working class whites who felt betrayed by the Democratic Party's embrace of the civil rights agenda. As one political insider explained, Reagan's appeal derived primarily from the ideological fervor of the right wing of the Republican Party and the emotional distress of those who fear or resent the Negro and who expect Reagan somehow to keep him in his place, or at least echo their own anger and frustration. To great effect, Reagan echoed white frustration in race-neutral terms through implicit racial appeal. His colorblind rhetoric on crime, welfare, taxes, and states' rights was clearly understood by white and black voters as having a racial dimension, though claims to that effect were impossible to prove. The absence of explicitly racist rhetoric afforded the racial nature of his coded appeals a certain plausible deniability. For example, when Reagan kicked off his presidential campaign at the annual Neshoba County Fair in near Philadelphia, Mississippi, the town where three civil rights activists were murdered in 1964, he assured the crowd, "I believe in states' rights," and promised to restore to states and local governments the power that properly belonged to them. His critics promptly alleged that he was signaling a racial message to his audience, suggesting allegiance with those who resisted desegregation. But Reagan firmly denied it, forcing liberals into a position that would soon become familiar, arguing that something is racist, but finding it impossible to prove in the absence of explicitly racist language. Crime and welfare were the major themes of Reagan's campaign, the rhetoric. According to the Edsels, one of Reagan's favorite and most often repeated anecdotes was the story of a Chicago welfare queen with 80 names, 30 addresses, 12 Social Security cards, whose tax-free income alone is over $150,000. The term welfare queen became a not-so-subtle code for lazy, greedy, black ghetto mother. The food stamp program, in turn, was a vehicle to let some fellow ahead of you buy a T-bone steak while you were standing in a checkout line with your package of hamburger. These highly racialized appeals targeted to poor and working-class whites were nearly always accompanied by vehement promises to be tougher on crime and to enhance the federal government's role in combating it. Reagan portrayed the criminal as a staring face, a face that belongs to a frightening reality of our time, the face of the human predator. Reagan's racially coded rhetoric and strategy proved extraordinarily effective, as 22% of all Democrats defected from the party to vote for Reagan. The defection rate shot up to 34% among those Democrats who believed civil rights leaders were pushing too fast. Once elected, Reagan's promise to enhance the federal government's role in fighting crime was complicated by the fact that fighting street crime has traditionally been the responsibility of state and local law enforcement. After a period of initial confusion and controversy regarding whether the FBI and the federal government should be involved in street crime, the Justice Department announced its intention to cut in half the number of specialists assigned to identify and prosecute white-collar criminals, and to shift its attention to street crime, especially drug law enforcement. In October 1982, President Reagan officially announced his administration's war on drugs. At the time he declared his new war, less than 2% of the American public viewed drugs as the most important issue facing the nation. This fact was no deterrent to Reagan, for the drug war from the outset had little to do with public concern about drugs and much to do with public concern about race. By waging a war on drug users and dealers, Reagan made good on his promise to crack down on the racially defined others, the undeserving. Practically overnight, the budgets of federal law enforcement agencies soared. In 1982, FBI anti-drug funding increased from $8 million to $95 million. Department of Defense anti-drug increased from $6 million in 1981 to $1,042 million in during that same period. DEA anti-drug spending grew from $86 million to $1,026 million. FBI anti-drug allocations grew from $38 million to $181 million. By contrast, funding for agencies responsible for drug treatment, prevention, and education was dramatically reduced. The budget of the National Institute on Drug Abuse, for example, was reduced from $274 million to $57 million from 1981 to 1984, and anti-drug funds allocated to the Department of Education were cut from $14 million to $3 million. Determined to ensure that the new Republican majority would continue to support the extraordinary expansion of federal government law enforcement activities and that Congress would continue to fund it, the Reagan administration launched a media offensive to justify the war on drugs. Central to the media campaign was an effort to sensationalize the emergence of crack cocaine in inner-city neighborhoods. Communities were devastated by the industrialization. The media frenzy the campaign inspired simply could not have come at a worse time in Americans. In the early 1980s, just as the drug war was kicking off, inner-city communities were suffering from economic collapse. The blue-collar factory jobs that had been plentiful in urban
areas.
Hopefully, we can get through.
For school PD, they want to know if it's going to be a battery or a child abuse.
Battery.
Roger.
3873, respond to Watchman's office.
3873, respond to Watchman's office. Trying for a crime update.
So it's our band, who are really good, and off we go.
You don't need no baggage, you just get on board.
All you need is
faith.
You don't need no ticket, you just bang.
Oh, that's great. I get one of this and it's 253 West 75th Street for a building search.
Faith is the key. Open the doors and board them.
This home for all Amanda's
Frank 5, 5, Frank 5, phone the Crow's office.